Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 4 years ago, Donald Trump promised to make America great again. At the Republican National Convention, he painted a semi-bleak picture of the American landscape, but paid it off with the boast, "Only I can fix it." He was met with cheers from the delegates in Cleveland. Now, there aren't many people who could get away with a statement like that, but Trump does, time and time again. In fact, he once called himself a very stable genius, and that serves as the title of a book by two reporters from The Washington Post, Philip Rucker and our guest this hour, Carol Lenig. Both of these Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters spent hundreds of hours talking with well over 200 administration officials and personal advisors to the president. When the book was released earlier this year, it made headlines for its revelations of some of what has gone on behind the scenes of this White House. And this hour, we hear more. Carol Lenig joins us for the hour in a kind of homecoming, because prior to going to the Washington Post, she worked for the Charlotte Observer for the last decade of the 1990s. And although she will be sitting in a studio at the Post, I'm going to welcome her home this hour. Carol Lenig, thank you for joining us on Charlotte Talks. I appreciate it.
I'm so delighted to be here. I wish I could be in person.
I want to tell people, your book is about the behind the scenes at the White House. So let's talk about the behind the scenes of what's been going on to get you in that chair. Traffic in Washington, traffic in D.C. is evidently not good at the moment. And we were going to start this on the phone in the elevator at the Post. And fortunately, at the last possible second, you sat in the chair. So congratulations.
It involved a little bit of running, and it makes me long for Charlotte, where the traffic was never really that demanding.
You should come back. things have changed. As we go through this book is fairly famous, and people have heard a lot about it, I'm sure, if you watch television, because Carol and her co-author, Philip Rucker, are contributors to MSNBC and NBC News, and they've been on television a lot talking about this. But if people have questions about what you discovered or about the book or about other things that we'll be talking about, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. So the full title of this book, A Very Stable Genius, is A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. By that, do you mean his testing of the institutions of our democracy that have sustained us for 240-plus years, or something else?
You know, it's a combination of things. It's both testing the norms of what we expect in a president. In almost every single way, Donald Trump has shaken up the snow globe we call Washington and the federal government. And the other way is testing some of the institutions and the sort of democratic principles that founded America. Many of the things that, you know, Washingtonians who study this government, people who operate in the federal government, work in the branches of it, have faith in key elements of the Constitution, key principles about America being a city on the hill that leads in a way by example the world and has the luxury to do so as a very stable democracy. But Donald Trump doesn't really buy into those norms or those principles, and is more running the federal government almost like Trump Organization from his tower in Trump Tower.
Well, isn't that exactly how he's running it? Because he spent his entire life in a small company. It may or may not have made billions of dollars over the years, but it was a small company, and he ran it. He was the king. He didn't report to a board of directors. It's the Donald Trump Company. Is that the way he's running this? Because that's what he knows how to do, right?
Absolutely correct. I mean, in the sense of the MO of this president. You know, he ran Trump Organization and also was extremely effective at making a lot of money and losing a lot of money, mm-hmm. Let's be clear. But it was his gut instinct that made the final decisions. He had a few aides, some of them family, and that's exactly the way it is in the White House right now. In the West Wing, it's a few members of his family and a very few number of trusted, loyal aides. And as we've seen in recent weeks, it's a president who is increasingly driving everyone out of the room that he doesn't have 150% faith in. Every president deserves to have loyal people at his side who want to serve him. But this president's litmus test for loyalty is pretty high, and he's purging that White House now.
And I'm glad you brought up that word purge, because a lot of pundits are using the word purge when it comes to what he's doing. And I heard, I don't know how true this is, that every president, of course, has the right to shape the people in his administration, to choose the people in his administration, and to make sure that they agree with whatever that president's agenda may be, because otherwise you're not going to get anything done if you don't have people working in your behalf. Most presidents do this early on. They identify the people they want in and want out in the transition period. And evidently Donald Trump didn't do that because he didn't have experience with that. So he's doing it now. Is that why we're calling it a purge, because it didn't happen early on, or is this something extraordinary?
I think this is actually pretty extraordinary and a little different. And I'll tell you how. You know, in our reporting for this book, A Very Stable Genius, Phil Rucker and I found that basically this is a president who is increasingly unchained. Some people would have said, hey, those first few weeks look pretty unchained. But he, with every obstacle he has hurdled, ones that would have fallen other presidents and eliminated other political candidates from consideration for office, every time he hurdles one of these obstacles, he becomes more and more emboldened and confident. One of them was, as a candidate, the revelation that he had bragged about being able to grab women's genitals because he's so famous he can get away with it. Most candidates would not survive that. He then next hurdles this incredible obstacle, which is a criminal investigation by Robert Mueller, looking at and finding significant evidence that he had obstructed a criminal probe. Usually that gets people sent to jail, but not a sitting president and not in this political environment. Next, he hurdles a House investigation, which in fairly quick order finds substantial evidence that he enlisted a foreign power to help him in what, you know, a very seasoned national security official called a domestic political errand, you know, helping him in his election and give him an advantage. He beat that. He beat all of those odds. And the result is that he's incredibly feeling invincible. Mm-hmm. And this purge is really about the trajectory of this presidency, driving all the grown-ups out of the room, driving all the people who don't tell him yes in a kind of obsequious way. He's no longer going to put up with anybody who's going to, for example, as Alexander Vindman did, comply with a House subpoena and tell House investigators what he heard in his job. He's no longer going to put up with a director of national intelligence, as he got rid of that person a couple of days ago, who tells him Russia's trying to interfere in the 2020 election.
Looking back on all this, if you just came to the decision to write this book today, one would have a clear understanding of why you would want to write this book, given the fact that you just elucidated just the big stories, and there have been hundreds of almost thousands of smaller stories since he first took office. But you started working on this. You've been working on this book for 3 years. You covered the first 3 years of his administration, and that's before the alarm bells were really ringing loudly in some quarters. What made you decide to write this, and when you decided to write this, did you have an agenda, or were you just trying to get a clearer understanding of how the president thinks and how his administration operates?
I take a deep breath for a minute, partially from the run this morning and partially because I really want to be thoughtful in answering this. It was a dizzying, an unprecedented kind of presidency to cover from the word go. I've covered 4 presidencies. This was like no other. Give Donald Trump credit for basically being the biggest generator of news in any presidency, the pace he has kept in terms of generating headlines, making amazing announcements that startle and surprise. It was so busy that we started to feel like we can't remember what we reported yesterday.
Yes.
There would be a shocking story on, we'd work all day on Thursday, his announcement of something that sort of upended all of Washington. And we had almost forgotten the story we spent all day reporting on Tuesday. So Phil and I both said, let's hit the pause button. We need to make sense of what's going on here and not rush through all of this barrage. And also try to make sense of the themes. What's really going on with Donald Trump in some of these rooms? What's motivating him? I have to say, it wasn't the easiest decision to make because our jobs were pretty demanding, and we didn't want to take too much time away from the president's, covering that reportage is important to us. And it was important to our editors at The Washington Post. So we didn't take very long in the way of leave, but we did want to do this, and we were really pleasantly surprised what we found.
In terms of?
You know, just that there was a pattern to many of these chaotic events. The president's North Star is the perpetuation of his own power and the burnishing of his own image on a daily basis. Every politician wants to stay in office or get reelected, at least most of them do. But in Donald Trump's case, we were learning from his own aides, the Republicans and conservatives who want to deliver on his agenda, who support him being in office. We were hearing from them over and over again in a way for the reporting for the book. They wouldn't talk to us for reporting in real time for the newspaper. And when we got them to break their silence, what they said is, this is a president who literally wakes up in the morning watching hours of television, trying to figure out who can he clobber that day, who's an enemy or a detractor, and how can he interrupt the narrative of the day to make it shine on him and shine on him in the best possible light.
So that information, that characterization came from people within the administration who decided to talk to you for the book. Is that correct?
That's right.
Why would they want to work for somebody like that?
Oh, such a good question. I mean, one is, I mean, they're not monolithic as a group of sources and or as senior aides, but one is that they genuinely believe in a conservative agenda, and they see a Republican president, though he's a rarely Johnny-come-lately Republican, they view a Republican presidency as a way to achieve those goals, whether it be appointing more conservative judges who have a stricter view of the Constitution, a more global interpretation of presidential powers, whether it be their view on how to fix the immigration problem we have in our country. Democrats and Republicans disagree very stridently about what the solution is, but nobody disagrees that there's a problem.
Right.
So that's one reason. Another reason these folks work for him is they kind of hit the lotto, to be honest, in some instances, to work in this White House. They would not have been qualified to work in another White House. This is a president whose friends referred to his transition effort as a Jabba the Hutt bar. You know, you didn't know who the heck was going to walk in. It wasn't a group of seasoned professionals. And the result is some of the people who are serving, even in his cabinet now or in senior leadership positions, are folks who really kind of jumped several rungs up the ladder.
But he said he was going to bring in the best people. So you're saying that they're not the best people? I only have 10 seconds.
No.
Okay. Carol Lenig is our guest, the co-author of A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. We'll get into greater detail on all this as we go through the hour. We're taking a break. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and our guest today is Carol Lenig, who, along with Philip Rucker, both reporters for The Washington Post, wrote a book that was released earlier this year called A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. It was a groundbreaking book. It made headlines around the country because of some of the revelations that it made public. After talking with 200 people and spending hundreds of hours with people from inside the administration. And I believe I heard you say, Carol, that when you were just writing for the paper, you and Philip, these people wouldn't talk to you. But you were writing a book. They decided to talk to you. Why?
It's a great question, Mike. You know, I think there are a lot of people in the president's orbit who are distraught and concerned because they view presidential decisions as ones that are made with a lot of information and a lot of care. And this president almost sees it as an insult to have information and briefing books brought to him and rejects that. He calls himself a game day player. He says he goes by instinct. Per your earlier point about how he ran Trump Org, he's running it like Trump Org. He's going on that instinct. And they're distraught because they see that that impulsivity and that rashness can lay waste to important policies. It can bungle a great diplomatic agreement that's in negotiation and it has possibilities of coming to fruition. They see the danger of it. And that's part of the reason they spoke to us, because we said, look, we're going to go deep. We're going to really tell this full story. Another reason they spoke to us is because they felt like, you know, history spoke to them. They know that history will judge them and perhaps this presidency harshly, but they want it to be accurate. Sometimes in the rush of the dizzying news cycle that we're in, people view reporters as folks who are just in for a cheap hit, right? We're just going to get a great little scoop. And in this instance, we're saying, no, we want to hear the whole thing. We want to hear the nuance, the detail. And I have to say, I'm indebted to these people because they shared with us things that I didn't understand in real time. Everyone thinks, for example, Kirstjen Nielsen, myself included, you know, was this evil person who wanted to cage children. But when we went back for the book and did the reporting, we learned the DHS secretary who served Donald Trump was a much more complicated character, and her role in that saga was almost forced on her at the beginning against her will. So it's that kind of motivation, I think, of historians to tell this story, to make sure we get it accurate, and to capture really what's going on with the president.
You covered the first 3 years, because we're in the fourth, of the Trump administration, and you talked to all these people, and you talked to them before this purge began, or before Donald Trump was cleared of by the Senate of any impeachment charges, which has seemed to have emboldened him. And he's always concentrated on people who are loyal to him, but now it's in spades. Could you write this book today? Would people talk to you today?
Well, you know, I have a particularly high sense of my ability to get people to talk, so I think yes. But I also think that genuinely, there are people in this administration who still want news to be carried to the public. And, you know, there is a dirty little secret, too, about this, which is the president's kind of management style has actually encouraged a lot of rivalries within the White House. It's created sources in a way for us in two ways. That first way is with the rivalries, because he kind of enjoys seeing people fight over his attention, fight for his attention. And those factions end up wanting to sort of share their version of events. Sometimes it's a little spun up and you got to de-conflict what's manipulated and what's real, but there's a little bit of that. Another way the president has created sources for me especially is he's crossed so many red lines in the national security and intelligence worlds that those folks who used to in their DNA run from us as reporters now are answering, you know, the bat phone.
Yeah, I was chuckling when you said when you were patting yourself on the back for being pretty good at getting people to talk to you, because you do have this reputation for not taking no for an answer, and you reported on problems earlier in your career with the U.S. Secret Service. They went through a series of embarrassing situations a couple of years ago, and you were able to penetrate what has been described as one of the world's most secretive organizations and one of its most closed cultures to get these people to talk to you. What is your technique? How do you do this?
You know, I'm a mother of two teenagers. And no, I mean, I think sometimes it's just being a listener. You know, if you are yourself and true and genuine, you invite someone in to tell their story. I also often think about journalism and sources in this way. I think about what is it that will motivate someone to talk to me, and what is it that is the fear that will keep them from talking to me. And I will want to very honestly in a conversation, sometimes when it's a cold call and the person doesn't know me from Adam, I will want to very quickly and honestly address the fear and the motivation and say, look, I know you're worried that this could come back to haunt you this way, and that is true, that is a risk, and here's how I think we could mitigate that risk. And then I'll try to address the motivation. You know, you're a public servant, for example, I'll say to the person, I know you care deeply about this. If you don't tell me about it, who will? How will the public learn it? And if you're honest and yourself and you don't try to play any games, people talk.
Hmm. You write in this book, there's so many major revelations that came out over the last several months that I'm assuming that a lot of people know about, but you write in this book about Donald Trump's woeful knowledge or lack of knowledge of American history, of law, of the Constitution, of world geography. Is that lack of knowledge the problem here, or is it an unwillingness or inability to learn, or is it just, I know everything already, don't bother me?
To answer that really good question, Mike, I'm going to give you a scene, which some of your listeners may have heard of. But we wrote, as the excerpt for the book, a chapter called Shocking the Conscience. And it's a moment when the really serious people who came to this presidency hoping to guide a novice apprentice president, General Mattis, Rex Tillerson, former Secretary of State, Gary Cohn, you know, a Wall Street guru, and then the National Economic Council of Advisors chief. These three people realize in the summer of 2017 that the president is not listening to them. He's fighting with them all the time about forward troop deployments overseas, the expense of that, military bases, which the president thinks we should charge other countries for the benefit of having our bases in their communities. We should make a profit off of our troops. And third, treaties and alliances and trade deals. The three amigos, I'll just use that term, they don't call themselves that, they agree that they're going to have this meeting at the tank, a sacred space in the Pentagon that they know the president likes. It's got gravitas. It's got history. It's the place where decisions of war and peace are made. They bring him to this room to try to explain to him why all of these things keep us safe. Here's why we have a base in the Korean Peninsula. Here's why we're fighting in Afghanistan and how we're doing it. Here's why we have NATO. And the president recoils at this Schoolhouse Rock vibe. He is just like, yeah. You're losers. These are loser wars. You're letting our allies get away with murder and not pay their fair share. If you guys ran businesses, you'd be broke. And then he says some things to them that we didn't know in real time, and we were shocked to learn. He says what is a curse word to these group of military officers and commanders gathered around the main conference table. He says, "You're dopes and babies. I wouldn't go to war with you people." Some of the people in that room saw a woman starting to cry, an officer shielding her face so that she would not be embarrassed and have people see this. Mike Pence, the vice president, is described in this scene as a wax museum figure. He says nothing. He's got a son who fought in Afghanistan, and he doesn't defend him and his reputation as a dope or a baby. He, you know, the Rex, forgive me, Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, no shrinking violet, Mad Dog Mattis, has his head bowed and is not responding. He's just sort of frustrated and quiet. And finally, according to the aides, Rex Tillerson decides, you know what? No one's going to say something. I have to. And he says, no, Mr. President, you're wrong. Most of everything you've said is wrong. That is not true. And men who put on the uniform, men and women who put on the uniform, they don't do it to make a buck. We're not here to make a profit. It's to protect our freedom. But that scene, Mike, encapsulates for us sort of how this president treats information. It is an insult to his instinctual way of managing. And he's the guy who really knows best. To his credit, and to detractor, forgive me, to allies of the president and supporters of the president, I just want to say one thing. Let's give the president credit, because the war in Afghanistan has been crazy long, a lot of lives lost, really, really questionable results, as published in our newspaper recently, the Afghanistan Papers. But the ad hominem way he attacked the people in that room, the disdain he showed for their service, and the rejection of information is the thing that made people finally break their silence and tell us what really happened.
And you say that was a watershed moment, because that when with that moment when Rex Tillerson stood up and said, no, Mr. President, you are wrong. Donald Trump is never wrong. It seems to me that's when he began, I think you say that's when he began to shut out his advisors. And I know you're not a psychologist, but what is it about him that he can't be wrong? Why does he think he knows better than everybody else about everything? No human being can know a lot, even a tiny amount, about everything.
I've thought a lot about this, and thank you for giving me a pass on being a psychologist, because I am not. And people always ask us this category, you know, what's his mental state, or what's his mental wellness, what's the feature that makes this happen. I can't diagnose or tell you that, but I can tell you what the people who served at his shoulder for months and years told us, which is that they view him as narcissistic. You know, the world revolves around his son. And so if he's the son,
S-U-N.
That's right. if he believes that, then everyone else is inferior, and their information is less valuable, and their knowledge is less valuable than his.
And we do need to give, I think, the president the benefit of the doubt on some things, because he did tell us before, while he was running for election, that things were crappy and that we needed to change how we operated the government, and the government was a stooge and we were not getting the bang for our buck and everybody treated us unfairly, and he was going to fix it. Only I can fix it. So he did tell us that in advance, and this is his approach. And he may be right about some of these things. But you write about his woeful ignorance of American history, and I think that plays into some of what's gone, some of what has alarmed people about this administration. You write about he was John Kelly, and he were taking the First Lady on a launch to the USS Arizona, which is the memorial in Honolulu for Pearl Harbor. And you say the president asked, "Hey, John Kelly, his advisor, what's this all about? What is this a tour of?" Now, that could be a question demonstrating ignorance of history, but couldn't it also be a question coming from a guy who's at the mercy of a crammed schedule, whose plane landed for refueling and they took him on this excursion and he didn't really know why?
Yes, Mike, I'm really grateful for this question, because that crossed my mind when we first heard the tip as well. We heard it from someone who heard it, you know, like a kind of a L'Oreal commercial. And I don't publish tips. We publish after we check this out, run it to ground, ask multiple people. And what happened was, the president understood, according to multiple people who reviewed this conversation and were briefed on it later, and he essentially knew a battle happened in Pearl Harbor. But when he turned to John Kelly and said, "What's this all about?" and Kelly begins to explain to him, Kelly realizes that the president doesn't really know that Japan attacked, that this is the foundational moment that propelled the United States in World War II. Now, the shocking thing about it is that most middle schoolers learn this. It's referred to as a day that will live in infamy. And it's possible the president learned this in school, too, and it just didn't pierce his consciousness. I don't know. But it flummoxed Kelly and many other White House aides who learned of it, because that's part of the American story. Yeah. And we should know the American story if we're going to lead the country.
Yep. You say Kelly was stunned by the question, and you quote one unnamed former senior advisor as saying that the president was at times dangerously uninformed. And you say oftentimes after meeting with the president, former Chief of Staff John Kelly, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, sometimes National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster would huddle, compare notes on something the president had just done or said, and in words, this is a quote from the book, in words and sometimes simply facial expressions, they communicated a shared concern. This guy doesn't know what he's doing. Now, you don't tell us who reported that to you. Is that because they only spoke to you on the basis that they would be anonymous?
Yes, many people spoke to us on the basis that they would not be identified. But again, we didn't take one person's word for it. We really ran these to ground. Okay. and talked to multiple sources.
And you also write about how people like former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson would watch really carefully when the president was speaking with foreign leaders, and he learned how to interject himself into those conversations to essentially save the president from revealing to the foreign leader he was talking to that he was out of his element, that he didn't master the facts of the situation. None of those people are there today. They're all gone. Who's serving that function now?
You know, we say the guardrails are gone. The people who said to the president, this might not be such a good idea, or when Rex Tillerson, for example, said to the president, you know, I'm not your guy to eliminate the anti-corruption statute called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that penalizes people who bribe foreign officials to get business.
Which the president said was unfair. Go ahead.
Yeah. Those people are indeed gone, and yeah. he's surrounded by yes men.
Carol Lenig is our guest. She's the author, along with Phil Rucker, of A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for The Washington Post, and we will continue in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. Join Charlotte Talks as we take our local news roundup across the border to South Carolina on Friday, February 28th. We'll broadcast live from Amelie's in Rock Hill. We'll talk about the South Carolina primary and the top Charlotte stories of the week. For information, go to wfae.org/charlottetalks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Carol Lenig is with us from The Washington Post, where she is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. She and her colleague there, Philip Rucker, have written A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. It came out a couple of months ago, and it made headlines for its revelations about what goes on behind the scenes at the White House. They talked to over 200 people in the administration over hundreds of hours to compile these findings in this book. Insiders told you, Carol, that Donald Trump can easily be talked into doing something or agreeing to something that he doesn't completely understand. He's pliable. And I think there's certainly enough evidence of that, which is done in full view. But he's also met with world leaders behind closed doors with no aides present and with the official note-taker dismissed. If what you write is true, that sounds incredibly dangerous and irresponsible. What was the opinion of administration insiders about that?
Oh, they were completely freaked out. I mean, even people who weren't experienced in, like, the Presidential Records Act, because not having a note taker and not keeping any records drives everybody crazy. Even people not familiar with that knew that this was a problem. They knew it was a problem when Jared Kushner was meeting sort of off book without anybody keeping really good records for the White House with foreign leaders. But when the president does it, it has this incredible power, right? He can make a decision on a dime. And there have been a couple moments when he's made that kind of decision on the dime based on his instincts that have just catapulted and thrown in the air mm-hmm. all the deck of cards that the federal government has laid out in such a careful order. I'll give you a couple of examples, or well, at least one. The president believed very strongly that he personally could help negotiate the release of a conservative pastor, Andrew Brunson, who was kind of a hero to evangelical communities. He'd been captured in Turkey and taken prisoner, had lived there, but taken prisoner as sort of a ward of the state. Mm-hmm. They viewed him as an enemy, a potential terrorist, which was a really trumped up crazy charges. But anyway, he was their captive. The president wanted to negotiate his release. Well, the whole federal government, the State Department, the military, intel agencies were involved in negotiating his release. And in fact, quite a few people at the State Department had a very well worked out plan, many multi-stage plan with the Turkish government, with their equivalent sort of grunts, if you will, in the diplomatic world in Turkey. But one day, you know, on the sidelines of a foreign meeting, Trump, you know, has a fist bump with Erdogan, Recep Erdogan, the president of Turkey, and he thinks he's made the deal of a lifetime to get Brunson released. It turns out that Erdogan played him because Trump calls Bibi Netanyahu in Israel, as he thought he was supposed to, gets the Israelis to release a Turkish prisoner on the dot, sent home back to Istanbul, and Trump thinks that now the pastor will be released, but that's not what happened. The pastor was released from the prison and put in home confinement in Turkey, and the president was fit to be tied. Well, everybody in the State Department who was working on this could have told him, hey, Mr. President, it's a bad idea to talk to Erdogan personally and privately without sidling up with us about the state of negotiations, because you've essentially, what they concluded actually was that the president gave Erdogan the idea that he could get more for his buck. He could get a little bit more in this negotiation than just turning over the pastor. And it was a fairly significant kerfuffle that could have been avoided if he just talked to his experts. Another example is when he's on the phone with Erdogan and Erdogan asks him to leave Syria, and the president on the phone says, fine, piece of sand, it's yours, I'm out of there. And that the consequence of that is the Secretary of Defense resigns.
And that's what we know about. So what don't we know about? Kim Jong-un, what happens in those meetings, his meeting with Putin, what don't we know about?
Oh, there's plenty, I'm sure. Hmm. But, I mean, in the book we also detail a few other cases where those private conversations leave the leaders feeling concerned. Is President Trump so easy to manipulate that if you flatter him or remind him of how amazing his inauguration crowd size was, that you can get what you want? Putin, for example, has famously said to Trump, you know, you and I, we could have a great partnership. We could get along great. It's just the deep state. It's just the people below us that are rooting against us. If we just ignore them, you know, we could do fine. Well, that's a KGB officer working an asset. At least that's the language that he's using.
Let's turn the tables on this just a little bit for a moment or two. Rachel on Twitter writes, I just think this is the president's personality. Narcissistic, maybe, but give him credit for all, big capital letters, all the positive changes he's made for our country. And people on the right, people in the conservative circles, applaud this president for everything he's doing. Are they wrong? And is the trade-off worth it?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I've had a really interesting group of people and great conversations with the president's supporters, from Texas to Omaha to, you know, Louisiana. I've had these amazing discussions where people say, I just love what he's really done and been able to change. And I ask them, what is it, the change that you've valued so much? Because what I can see concretely and what they ultimately acknowledge concretely that he has accomplished is a relatively small thing. He gave us a lot of tax cuts that overwhelmingly benefited a higher income group. And he also delivered a pledge that he would increasingly defang regulatory agencies. But a lot of that defanging, except for at EPA, really hasn't happened yet. Most of the defanging has been found to be illegal and has been challenged in courts. So when we look at the list of what he's done, a lot of these supporters ultimately have to agree that what he's done is he's talked about a lot of things that they value, but that has not necessarily always resulted in policies.
But he has, thanks to Mitch McConnell, been successful at filling vacant court vacancies that have been vacant for years because Mitch McConnell wouldn't let them go through. And that will be, I think, his legacy, don't you think? The fact that he's going to tilt the entire court system to the right.
Yes, absolutely. And his supporters definitely have him to thank for that. But they also have someone to thank for it who's no longer, who was driven out of the room. Don McGahn was an amazing partner, a White House counsel, former White House counsel, was an amazing partner with Mitch McConnell trying to get those judgeships filled by conservative-leaning judges. Some might say alt-right judges in some cases. Forgive me, let me correct myself. Very conservative, far-right judges, not alt-right.
Okay.
And the president apparently didn't really give Don McGahn much credit for this because he ended up, you know, insisting on having him removed sooner than McGahn planned on leaving. Anyway, it's just an interesting thing that people credit the president with that. It will be his legacy, but he didn't really do a lot to accomplish it.
A lot of pundits have said that because of the Mueller report, because the Mueller report did not have the impact that people on the left thought it would or hoped it would, and because he successfully went through the Senate with absolution, I suppose is the way to say it, from impeachment, that it has emboldened him. And now he's completely unfettered, and all future presidents, the precedent has been set that the president can do pretty much whatever he damn well pleases. I spoke yesterday with U.S. Army Lieutenant General Michael Nagata, who for 38 years was in the Army and is the former director of strategic operational planning at the National Counterterrorism Center. And we spoke about this very topic, and he said that he was convinced of the resilience of our system of government, its checks and balances, and of the enormous machine that is the federal government and its ability to withstand all these pressures coming from Donald Trump. He said that all presidents try to push the envelope in some way or another, and the government pushes back. That's the way it's designed. But if you listen to pundits on the network that you often appear on, MSNBC, you'd think the world was ending. And your co-author, Philip Rucker, covers the White House every day. You report extensively on this. This isn't your first time at the rodeo. So do you agree with General Nagata, or do you have more serious misgivings?
I think the general has a fantastic point, because we're all counting on that kind of push-pull in any presidency, a president who's as unusual as Donald Trump, or a president who's as sort of mild-mannered maybe as Barack Obama. We're counting on that push and pull because it's the check and balance that makes us feel like somebody's watching the store and somebody's trying to get their job done, but others are being careful and measuring that out. Here's what worries me, though. In the last few weeks, almost as presaged by our book, this trajectory of an emboldened president, somebody who's triumphed over all of these things that would have leveled another candidate, in the last few weeks, the president has taken aim at Supreme Court justices and said they shouldn't be hearing cases involving him. That's a branch of government that's supposed to be independent. In the last few weeks, the president has weighed in on what the sentence should be for a friend of his who, according to a judge, covered up for Donald Trump. Four prosecutors withdrew from that case out of fear and concern that it appeared the sentencing was going to be reduced in pressure from the Department of Justice and Attorney General Bill Barr. That is an agency that's extremely special and unique. Blind justice. It's supposed to be objective and without fear or favor. The fact that the president is wanting to weigh in on that and push on that and appeared to have succeeded, appeared, I stress appeared, because the sentencing recommendation was reduced as he had wanted. That's worrisome. Are other presidents going to feel like it's okay to go after judges, to go after Justice Department decisions? That is a worry.
But I understand the Justice Department part of that equation, but there's nothing he can do about the Supreme Court. He can criticize them all they want. They have lifetime appointments, and they're not going to recuse themselves.
Well, you know, he can. That's true. I would think you're probably right. But there are a lot of things we thought were just common sense and would never happen. But never have thought.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Let's talk about that for a second, because a lot of the stuff that we have taken, a lot of the stuff that's happened under this presidency that shocks us, many people thought was codified. Many people thought you can't do that because surely that's against the law. Well, it's not. It's just been tradition. And that's how we've done things. And we've expected our presidents to honor that tradition because it's the right thing to do, the moral thing to do, the American thing to do. He doesn't follow that pattern. But it's not illegal. Do you think when he leaves office, it will become codified, all of these behaviors that we've I'll leave it at that. Do you think it will become codified?
Yeah. You know, it's hard to tell. I like facts. I don't like to speculate. Okay. I'm a journalist. But I will say that it really depends on voters and the other branches of government, particularly Congress. Congress has given this president a massive pass for things that would have been viewed as devastating misconduct in the past.
Right.
And they did that in large measure because voters who support Donald Trump in their district will turn on those candidates who don't support Donald Trump. Donald Trump will flick on the light switch against or for candidates, Republicans, who go against him or support him.
The New York Times, when they reviewed your book, said it, quote, reads like a horror story, an almost comic immorality tale. It's as if the president, as patient zero, had bitten an aide, and slowly, bite by bite, an entire nation had lost its wits and its compass. Is that how you've come to view what you revealed in this book?
I don't like to describe it as a horror story. I do think that other people can make that judgment on their own. Extremely grateful and humbled for the New York Times review. You know, our major competitor said this was a history book that will stand the test of time, and I'm grateful for their view of that book. We're just humbled and honored that it's resonating so much with readers, that so many people are buying it, and whether they're Republican or Democrat, are valuing the facts that we've assessed and brought here. I don't like characterizing the work other than to tell you that we took you in the room because we thought it was really fascinating, and we thought it drew a portrait of this president, a president like no other.
Just so people will understand how quickly things have been moving and how in-depth is that you wanted to write this book to take stock. I thought this book came out months ago. No, it was released January 21st. It seems like eons ago.
That's how time is in this news cycle, right?
Yep. I have about 30 seconds. Whether Donald Trump leaves the White House next January or in 2025, can we return the presidency and the institutions of American government to the normalcy that preceded him? Can we restore trust in those institutions, or has he irrevocably changed all of that?
I think he's definitely changed some things. It remains to be seen exactly how, but he's definitely changed the playing field.
Carol Lenig, the Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for The Washington Post, she, along with her co-author Philip Rucker, wrote A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. And Carol, for all the trouble it took you to get there this morning, I thank you for the hour.
I loved it, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.